Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we have a very, very interesting guest in store for you today, and a fascinating topic. We talk about the Paleolithic diet. We've had several guests talking about a diet that seems all the rage, a lot of people espousing paleo eating. Today we have a guest who's going to talk about, yes, the paleo diet, but also is going to talk about the paleo lifestyle. He's written a fascinating book. It just came out, The Paleo Manifesto, Ancient Wisdom for Lifelong Health. And I'm holding it in my hands as we record this podcast. It's really actually quite heavy because it's carved on a stone tablet with a piece of flint. No, actually not. Our guest, John Durant, is probably used to jibes and taunts from some of the people who've interviewed him so far. He's been a guest on the Colbert Report and on NPR. He's also been featured in the New York Times. And he is a leader of the growing ancestral health movement. Yes, there is such an entity. And amazingly, in an urban environment, he is a leader of a paleo support group and a barefoot running group, Paleo NYC and Barefoot Runners NYC. And his background is that while a student at Harvard, John studied evolutionary psychology prior to getting involved in this field. And so, John, let me reassure you, this is not going to be the usual interview. I'm not going to ask you about a paleo dating in New York. You take a club and you hit your quarry over the head and then you drag her back by the hair to your cave.
I think they call that 50 Shades of Grey these days.
50 Shades of Grey, that's not the topic. And so, you know, it's hard to live in New York in a cave with a campfire because of the there's certain zoning regulations, I think, against caves and campfires in Manhattan.
Well, I've really brought the caveman jokes on myself because I do happen to resemble the Geico caveman.
Well, you know, I have to say, you know, because there's a great picture of John in the book jacket here, and he sort of embodies the look of the handsome Cro-Magnon. He's got penetrating blue eyes, and he's got long brunette hair, and he's got not quite the beard isn't down to his knees. He's not trying to emulate ZZ Top, but he has a nice growth of beard, and he looks very paleo. So, but you know, that's part of, I think, you're positioning this, and you know, you're in the media, and you're conscious of your image, and I think that it suits your messaging very well. But the book is actually a very serious and comprehensive manifesto, which talks about the argument for acknowledging our Paleolithic background, and it ranges very, very widely. His background is in psychology. He also brings in lessons from history and literature and anthropology to support his message. Tell us a little bit, John, about how you got involved, because you have a story of personal transformation that you talk about in the new book.
Yeah, I had never, growing up, paid very much attention to a lot of attention to my health at all. It came sort of easily to me, and then, like a lot of people, after graduating from college, first desk job, seems like your metabolism slows down. In New York City, it's sort of the work hard, play hard lifestyle, and it's no wonder that people get unhealthy if they're not sleeping a lot, drinking too much alcohol, getting no sun, not exercising, eating poorly, things like that.
So you graduated from Harvard, and many of your Harvard peers may have gotten jobs as investment bankers or in hedge funds or working for corporations, and they're desk-bound and they're connoisseurs of all the best restaurants. They're a hard-drinking, hard-playing group.
I wouldn't say the best restaurant. I'd say takeout restaurant.
Okay.
You've got the wrong idea.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, these days a college education only goes so far, even if you go to the Ivy League. So you found yourself getting a little bit behind the eight ball.
Look, I didn't want to adopt some fad diet. I had never been on a diet before in my life. There's such a stigma around the word diet. Oftentimes women have a stigma with the word diet because they've been on diets that failed before in the past. Some men try to seem more macho and don't ever want to be on a diet or something like that. And that's actually the same reason why I didn't want the word diet in the title of my book, why I described it as a manifesto, because it's more of a worldview to look at a healthy, holistic lifestyle, an entire habitat that you live in, informed by evolution, informed by our ancestral past.
And what are some of the lessons that you derive from your studies of history and anthropology as applies to optimal lifestyle?
Well, you know, I don't even start the book in the Paleolithic. That's one of the things that differentiates this book from other paleo books is that I actually go on a trip to the Cleveland Zoo where I had heard about in the press this amazing intervention that they had done where they had shifted the diet of some gorillas away from essentially processed pet food bars supplemented with vitamins and things like that to a diet that more closely resembled the diet of wild gorillas. So leafy greens and stems and things like that. And they just got amazing health results. The gorillas lost 50 to 70 pounds. They are around 50 pounds. The behavioral problems went away. Their progression of heart disease actually halted. Did you know that heart disease is the number one killer of male gorillas in captivity?
Wow. Yeah, that's an amazing statistic.
They'll have, say, a 21-year-old gorilla go into cardiac arrest and just fall over and die and have a heart attack and die.
That would be the equivalent of what, like a 50-year-old human?
More or less. And so there's this interesting movement in the zoo world where they've been borrowing medical technology from us, from human health for a while, but there actually hasn't been much going back in the other direction where we start to borrow concepts from some of the top zoos in the world. And here's the approach that they take. It's very simple. It's very straightforward. They mimic an animal's natural habitat. And you don't have to mimic all aspects of it to get an animal to be healthy or to avoid different chronic health conditions, but you've got to think holistically about the entire habitat. So not just food, but temperature and movement and the surfaces that are available and the social relationships that are available to the animals there. Here's why I wanted to start the book in this place. Because everybody has opinions about human health. If you start with humans, nobody will ever agree on anything. Because everybody arrives to the conversation with preconceived notions and positions that they feel like they have to defend. But very few people have an opinion on how to keep a Western lowland gorilla healthy in captivity. So by taking this approach, I'm trying to find some common ground among a wider audience to get buy-in on taking this more holistic habitat-based evolutionary approach.
Well, that's a wise strategy because, as everybody knows, there's some things you just can't argue about. You can't argue about religion, you can't argue about politics, and you can't argue about diet because people have fixed opinions and they're not going to budge.
It is amazing how much dietary views can be very wrapped up in religious views. I mean, you look at any religion around the world, it's not exclusive to any one of them, and eating traditions are core to who's in and who's out. So it's a subject with a lot of strong opinions.
Well, you studied psychology at Harvard by choice because you found it of interest. What are some of the lessons that evolutionary psychology provides us about the way we should be living?
Well, I started getting attracted to evolutionary psychology because it made sense of some very simple things very easily. So why do many people have an instinctive fear of height? Oh, right, because if you didn't have a fear of height, oops, you tumbled over the cliff and died, right? There's some real simple approaches like that. And what you realize is how strong the influence of the past is on us today.
We're hardwired for some of these things. Fear of snakes. We're the cars that you point out in your book that kill us wholesale by the tens of thousands. We don't have an instinctive fear of cars, as you know. No. We walk up to our car in our driveway and turn the key.
Yeah, but look down and see something that might resemble a snake, and people leap away. Of course, all these things can be modified by experience, and that's the power of the human brain. But the past lies heavy on the future or on the present. So I wanted to, people have this notion that the mind and the body are separate things and they're divorced from each other. And no matter what you do to your body, your mind and your spirit and who you are as a person kind of sits above it. And what I started to realize more and more was how silly this notion was and how much everything in the body is interrelated and biological. And what, I went through some up and down periods sort of at the end of college and at the beginning of the work when I was out of college. And I realized how much things like my amount of sleep, how much exercise I'd gotten, what I was eating, influenced my mind and my outlook on the world. So initially I found this depressing. At one day I had this realization that you can actually, if you understand how your body works, you can take control and feel better about yourself.
So it's kind of like the care and feeding and environment of a mountain gorilla. We can actually boil this down to a few essential facts and apply this to our lifestyles.
Yeah, exactly. And make it practical. You know, so much of my work in college was very theoretical and writing papers, and it really didn't have an influence on my day-to-day life. And it wasn't until much later when I said, wait a second, the famous saying is nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. So, it's perfectly natural, and appropriate to use this evolutionary point of view to very quickly arrive at relatively intelligent, educated guesses at what is probably healthy. I mean, evolutionary theory cannot, you know, just because somebody ate a certain way during the Paleolithic or lived a certain way doesn't mean that that is necessarily the optimally healthy way for everybody to live today.
Well, some people would argue that the pace of evolution is brisk enough that we have evolved over a period of a mere few thousand years to be able to eat foods that weren't available to our ancestors, to do things, to live a lifestyle that is quite divorced from our ancestral origins. What's your take on that?
Well, I think it's absolutely correct that human evolution continues to this day. It's never stopped, and in some aspects, it's sped up as population has grown and things like that. And that's one of the reasons why in my book, I don't just stop at the Paleolithic. After learning about hunter-gatherers, I get to go on a trip to the Harvard Fossil Archive and get to hold an 80,000-year-old hunter-gatherer skull in my hand. It was so cool. I was so afraid I was going to drop this skull. Oh, I mean, you know that feeling?
Yeah.
It's some very simple task, and you're like, you do not drop this. This
right.
is a priceless treasure. And I didn't. I was holding it over a table. But after the Paleolithic and learning about what we can learn from hunter-gatherers and our past, I do spend chapters about what we can learn from more recent ancestors, because there's a lot. So during the agricultural age, one of the strongest areas of recent selection has been related to the immune system and infectious disease, because people started living in cities, they had domesticated animals around, infectious disease goes through the roof. And so things, so the immune system becomes very important. Are you going to have a strong enough immune system, even as your diet is getting worse, You go from a diet of eating wild salmon and blueberries to eating whole rye bread all day, every day. So even as diet is getting worse, the demands on your immune system are going up, and they're finding that that area of the genome has had tons of selection pressures over the last few years. So I spend a chapter looking at how a lot of cultural traditions, I delve into the Bible, and I look at how a lot of early religions, particularly Judaism, a lot of these had very strong hygiene codes and purity codes that were a cultural mechanism to allow people adapt to this novel habitat, which was urban living. So things like hand washing. People typically credit the discovery of hand washing to a Hungarian physician named Ignaz Semmelweis in the 19th century. And he discovered it because there were doctors that weren't washing their hands, delivering babies, and then performing autopsies in an adjoining morgue. It just makes you want to pull your hair out. But you go back and you look in the Bible and in Exodus, and you have references to hand washing even after touching a corpse, going back 2,500 years.
And as every Orthodox Jew practices this on a daily basis, is that before a meal there's a hand washing that has become more a ritual than an exercise in hygiene, because we, you know, many of us are taught to wash our hands anyway, but it's really embedded in the culture.
It is, and it's before eating bread, before a meal, after waking up, after going to the bathroom, after touching anything unclean, a whole host of different scientifically sound examples. People talk about it as a ritual, and that's how many religious folks interpret it. But if you turn back the clock 3,000 years and you think and you put yourself in the mind of a person back then, and they don't know that germs exist, right? It's just this, some people end up dying from these gruesome, mysterious deaths, and people, because germs can spread so easily by the slightest physical contact, it's very hard to discern causation and what is actually causing people to die. So a lot of people attributed all these deaths to being struck down by God, and miracle of miracles, you get a cultural tradition around this time that says, you need to wash your hands, you need to bathe, you need to wash your clothes, you need to inspect your food to make sure it's not contaminated by insects.
Certain foods were deemed unclean, kosher laws, dietary strictures.
That's right. People love to argue about pork and shellfish, and those are the law. If you're brought up outside of the Jewish tradition, those are the kosher laws that you hear about the most, but those, in many ways, those aren't even the most important ones. Some of the most important ones are avoiding vermin. There was just a news article the other day about a kid in Kazakhstan. I want to say it was Kazakhstan, but it may not have been Kazakhstan.
I think it was. I mean, notwithstanding, you know, the Borat movie, I think it was in Kazakhstan. I know the story you're about to tell us about. Share it.
Yeah, he killed and ate a what species was it? It wasn't a mole. It was a some type of varmint.
Okay.
And contracted bubonic plague from a tick that had been on the animal, and that during the process of killing it and handling it and skinning it and cooking it had infected him. And it's a painful lesson in that certain species can transmit disease much more easily than others. So the Jewish kosher laws, kashrut, focused on avoiding insects, aside from locusts, crickets, and grasshoppers, insects, rodents, and vermin, corpses, any animal that had died of its own accord, and animals that die of its own accord are more likely to be diseased, and then protected species that also tended to eat corpses or carrion or things like that, like vultures and top-level carnivores, that, as any farmer knows, if you have a diseased animal that just falls over in a field, the coyotes or a mountain lion or birds of prey will devour it, and the carcass will be gone in a few days at most.
Well, let's take a look at some of the components of the paleo manifesto as you lay it out. It's not just about diet, but let's start from the standpoint of diet. What are some of the lessons of our Paleolithic past that we might do well to emulate in our modern food selections?
What everyone agrees is generally avoiding industrial processed foods. And one of the things that I make a point to emphasize as I look at the conventional wisdom is that we call processed foods processed. But processing in and of itself is not necessarily an unhealthy thing. You could cook your food, or you could add spices to it, or seasonings, or even cut it, or tenderize it. And these are ways of making, can make food more nutritious. When most people say processed food, they really mean industrially processed food. Industrial processing methods, industrial ingredients, and so most people agree that an industrial diet of frozen pizza and Twinkies and Coca-Cola ain't good for you, right?
I think it's general consensus now.
Right. but language is important, because the point that I wanted to make is that, well, before the Industrial Revolution, how did we eat? Well, we ate like farmers, because most people were farmers, they lived on farms, and what do farmers grow? Well, they grow grain, they grow wheat and corn, barley and oats, and then they herd animals, and they have dairy, and eat animal foods. And so a lot of the conventional wisdom when it comes to health actually boils down to eat like we did before the Industrial Revolution.
That's sort of Michael Pollan's contention, the omnivore's delight, eat a wide variety of foods, and, you know, don't get too hung up.
Yeah, and don't eat foods your great-grandmother wouldn't recognize as food. Exactly right. And so you combine that eat like a farmer with a low-fat advice, and what you get is sort of what you find in Whole Foods, which is a heavily plant-based diet. A lot of people end up eating seeds and grains and legumes a lot.
That's all of my patients say, I try to avoid saturated fat, when they come in to see me. I limit my red meat, I don't eat red meat at all. They always
exactly.
Think that that's the badge of virtue when it comes to diet.
And the problem is that the science, the nutrition science over the last half decade that sent us down this path of villainizing fat, a lot of it was just poorly conducted. And it wasn't just the studies around fat. It's very hard to run properly controlled, large-scale health trials, no matter what you're studying, because it's expensive, it's time consuming, it's politicized, there are ethical issues, it can be difficult to monitor that people actually are complying. There are all sorts of problems. It's a very difficult issue to get a handle on, and a lot of those early studies ended, in retrospect, looked like a lot of fear mongering. There's saturated fat in human breast milk. Should we strip out the saturated fat in breast milk so that babies, don't get set on a path to early heart disease? No, that would be absurd. It would be utter nonsense. And so I think we need to stop villainizing a single macronutrient like fat that has been in the human diet for millions of years, right?
So what constitutes your diet? You've adopted a paleo-type diet for yourself personally. You advocated as part of your group in New York, the Paleo NYC. What does that consist of?
So I do a modified paleo diet. I incorporate a little bit of full-fat dairy, because I find that I do fine on dairy and I enjoy it. So I'll have some grass-fed butter or a little bit of heavy cream or sour cream. I don't buy tons of cheese, but if I'm out at a party, I don't, and there are cheese for hors d'oeuvres, I'll have some of that.
Recognizing that this is a big controversy within the paleo movement, because some people would argue that it's not natural for mammals to consume breast milk from a foreign mammal past the age of infancy.
That's right. That's exactly right. And this is one of those areas where when people start out, if they want to experiment with paleo, I actually recommend in the book that they start with a completely, quote, orthodox approach. Remove grains, remove dairy entirely, try it for a month or some period of time to get a read on it and see how you feel. And then you can one by one or slowly reintroduce different foods. And if you feel fine on certain, this is the point at which you need to experiment. You are in charge of customizing your own diet to fit your goals, your needs, your health, your genome, your culture, and create your own unique diet. And that's fine. So I've found that I enjoy some full fat dairy, and it doesn't seem to adversely impact my health. I know if I'm eating too much because my skin, I start to break out a little bit and get some pimples. So I can sort of calibrate based on that. And so I think that's good. I think paleo can be an excellent starting point. It doesn't have to be everybody's ending point.
Right. What are some of the real no-nos on the paleo diet? Now, grains, from an evolutionary standpoint, perhaps we can go back 8,000-12,000 years, but before that, t'weren't no grains. So is that essentially eliminated from paleo?
Yeah, where there's far more agreement and consistency around people who eat paleo is around grains, particularly wheat. Wheat seems to have been singled out as particularly harmful when consumed in large quantities, and you have a lot of people trying to adhere to gluten-free diets. There are lots of other different molecules that we are going to learn about besides gluten that cause inflammation or can irritate people's stomachs and things like that. So on the most people's scale, wheat would be on the worst side of things. Something like white rice, which is basically carbohydrate. If you want more carbohydrate in your diet, white rice is a good option.
Mm-hmm. What about legumes? Legumes are domesticated, also of recent origin, problematic for some people.
Well, if you look at legumes, in many legumes in their natural state, in their raw state, are quite toxic and poisonous. So the poison ricin is made from castor beans, wild almonds, not domesticated ones, but wild ones, have cyanide in them. Apple seeds have cyanide in them. You don't want a rabbit to eat apple seeds. Any type of seed, and by seed, I'm using that term a little bit differently than most people use it. When I say seed, I actually think of the reproductive organ of these plants. So grains, legumes, nuts and seeds. I think any of those consumed in large quantities can be problematic. When you look at legumes, how they've been traditionally prepared in cultures over the last few thousand years, it's with things to detoxify them and make them edible and more nutritious. So soaking, sprouting, cooking, and they often require a lot of it. The other thing that we've known going back thousands of years, which Greek, or is a Rome, one of the Greek or Roman orators would write about how eating beans would cause flatulence.
That was made the first scientific reference to that fact.
Yeah, I like to eat what I call not a low-fat diet, but a low-fart diet.
Okay, there we go.
There's the bathroom humor.
It had to be said. It had to be said.
That's right. Legumes is one of those areas where if you are having digestive issues, inflammatory issues, autoimmune issues, they're a very good candidate for removing from your diet. And I also sort of know my own health now, and my stomach is very healthy. I eat fermented foods. And so if I go out to a nice restaurant and there is, I was at a French restaurant where they had this amazing roasted duck with white bean cassoulet, and I'm going to eat the white beans. Like, I'm not going to, in that situation, I know myself and my health, and I can eat that and feel completely fine.
And apropos of French restaurants, you know, you're a young guy living in New York and, you know, hanging out, socializing, you know, networking. And what role does alcohol play in a Paleolithic diet? Because, I mean, you do mention in the book that people had a proclivity to ferment sugary or carbohydrate things from early on. So is alcohol Paleolithic under certain circumstances?
Well, if you do look at some other primates, some do have the ability to digest and metabolize alcohol. But alcohol in any significant quantity, like we're talking about, didn't enter the human diet until the agricultural revolution. Look, it's one of those things where it's a cost-benefit analysis. I'm a young, single, social guy in New York, which makes it difficult to completely cut alcohol out of my diet. What I do know is if I drink more than a couple of drinks, I feel a little bit slower the next day. My motivation is down. I probably damage my gut bacteria because alcohol, a lot of microorganisms can't survive in alcohol. And my performance declines. So I try, when it comes to alcohol, I try not to overindulge, either at any given moment or too frequently. I try to stick to low sugar options. So I stay away from sweet sugary mixers like tonic or Coke.
No umbrella drinks.
No umbrella drinks. I just try to, if there is going to be something sweet in there, I would just rather have it be like an actual fruit juice or a squeezed orange or some lemon or things like that, or a margarita that's actually made with lime juice rather than some sort of knockoff margarita mix. And then I try to stick with gluten-free. So I'll if there's hard cider available, I'll pick that over beer. However, if I'm in a situation where it would be completely emasculating to not have a beer, I go for a beer.
So flexibility is the key to this. So your personal experience of this is that you know, you've lost 20 plus pounds of you know, you're not like you weren't fat, but maybe you're no. You know, getting a little chunky, a little puffy, you know, like some people in their late 20s and 30s after they get out of school and their metabolism slows down a tad. And you really tuned up around this.
Yeah, for me it wasn't, the weight came off very easily, but my primary concern wasn't weight loss. Mine was actually energy level and mood. Mm-hmm. A lot of people talk about spiking and crashing. What they don't talk about quite so much is how your mood and outlook on things can spike and crash right along with your energy level. So I would go from optimistic to pessimistic to optimistic over the course of a meatball sub and a cup of coffee.
You know, there's medication for that. Bipolar disease can be treated.
Yeah, right.
Lithium, right. Lithium works really well on that.
Well, I'm thinking about electroshock therapy.
Okay. yeah, I don't know. Maybe, you know, there was lightning in Paleolithic era. And, you know,
Yeah.
I think, you know, one of the strengths of your book is that you don't fixate particularly on diet. There's a very strong section on diet and foods, but you also look at other elements of the paleo experience. And, you know, I just will remark, this interview is being conducted via Skype. You're listening to a recording of this interview, but John can see me and I can see John. And John, if he looks at me, will see me seated with headphones in front of a microphone. And as I look at John, I see him, you know, he's sort of bobbing and weaving and he's clearly standing. And in your book, you actually make mention of the importance of standing, walking, and that something about sitting is just not very paleo, and we spend so many hours of our day in an unnatural seated position.
Well, there have been a number of studies that have come out really over the last year and a half, showing that sitting is unhealthful in its own right, independent of whether you are exercise for 45 minutes at the gym.
So the 4 mile run that I did this morning, and then I decided to do desk work all day and conduct interviews, the sitting counteracted the benefits of the run, in effect.
Well, you're not getting it. I don't know if it directly counteracted them, but you're less healthy than you would be if you were on your feet more.
Okay.
And some of the studies show that even if you just stand up occasionally, every 15 minutes or so, that can be enough to essentially reactivate your metabolism and sort of reactivate the body. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be on your feet all day long. Even if you look at hunter-gatherers, they're active during daytime, but then when they're done, they lie around and they sit and they sleep. You know, they're not on their feet all day long.
And rest is a very important component of the Paleolithic lifestyle because, some people think that, the more they can be doing their triathlon training, two workouts a day, 3,000 yard pool workouts, the better. But that actually, in some ways, not very paleo.
Well, Art Devaney, who is an early paleo guy, he made a great point in his book where he talked about the importance of doing nothing. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I loved that. I loved how he described that. We are on all the time these days in New York City and in other places with our phones and our gadgets and our computers. And it is more than ever, we need off time. We need downtime where we turn those things off. We focus on personal relationships. We relax. We're not stressed out having to think about work or a bad boss or credit card debt or things like that. So it's really important. This is something that I fail at all the time. It's really important to try to just de-stress and take it easy and do nothing. And that's okay. That's good.
And when it comes to exercise, I mean, you yourself have pioneered a barefoot running group here in New York City, and you have some unique ideas about exercise, that kind of depart from our usual conventional views.
Well, it's funny. When you look at any part of the body, using it appropriately, people understand that muscles get stronger and you become healthier when you exercise it and use it appropriately. Suddenly you get to the foot and everybody wants to not use it and put this tool on the feet, the shoe that constricts its shape. And we, rather than using your own arch and making that strong, we depend on the arch and the shoe. And we really baby the foot and it's too bad because the feet are our connection with the ground. They are the foundation of how we move. And it's core to balance. It's core to any type of athletic activity you want to do, whether it's running, walking, basketball, anything like that. I mean, you pick a sport and footwork is extremely important, or dancing, any of these things.
And you reserve some criticism for some people who methodically do 20 minutes on the elliptical every day or who single-mindedly train for the marathon with long, exhausting runs, 7 days a week, because you don't think that is part of our evolutionary heritage.
Well, variation is very important. A lot of people, runners in particular, get repetitive stress injuries. They get runner's knee or shin splints or ankle and foot problems. It would be one thing if runners and running today was a low injury sport. I wouldn't have too many complaints in that case. But it's not. And runners get injured all the time doing it in the conventional way. And the book Born to Run by Chris McDougall, and there's a Harvard professor named Dan Lieberman who have really been at the forefront of this, not me, been looking at how shoes, particularly high-heeled running shoes, frequently change people's stride when they run and causing them to land with their heel, what's called a heel strike, instead of a more natural running stride, which would be a gentle forefoot strike, landing with the front of the foot first, and then allowing the heel come down and kiss the ground. And this is, if you actually look at top marathon runners, if you go over to Africa and you look at how rural Kenyan children run, run in the schoolyard, they tend to run with a gentle forefoot strike or a midfoot strike, and they have incredibly healthy feet. Very low incidence rates of collapsed arches. It's basically non-existent in habitually barefoot cultures. I cite a study. I was just shocked, absolutely shocked when I came across this study, that upwards of 80% of American women have some sort of foot deformity.
Absolutely.
And it's just awful, from high heels and very constricted shoes and it just our general lack of attention to foot health. And we get children on the wrong foot, so to speak, right at the beginning, because children's shoes, this is another area where I go off, they are so horribly designed.
You think that children's shoes, to some extent, is an oxymoron, right?
The children should be barefoot whenever possible. As long as they're not in a parking lot with broken glass,
right.
Let them be barefoot.
Right.
If they're in the house, if they're in the backyard, if they're playing in a field somewhere, let them run around barefoot. They're not going to die. And children, this is when their feet are developing. And they need to use their feet for them to get stronger and for the bones to grow and for the arch to grow stronger and for the muscles and tendons to get stronger. I mean, you look over, here's an extreme example, but you go over to China and their traditional methods of foot binding, which are just awful, but they would bind women's feet when they were young and they would become deformed and small and they would take the shape of the container that they were given. And so when we're forcing children to use these shoes all the time, we're also in some ways deforming their feet and not allowing them to grow properly.
But you actually don't advocate that people just run. You favor a very diversified approach to exercise, which is embodied in the current craze, the CrossFit movement, where people do a different workout every day and they mix it up.
Yeah, everybody's a little bit different and CrossFit may not be right for everyone and that's fine. It doesn't have to be. But what I enjoy about it is that it's fun and it forces me to be more varied in my workouts. If it's just up to me and I go to the gym, I end up doing the same five exercises over and over. I run on the treadmill. I do a little bench press. I do some bicep curls. Maybe I jump rope if I'm feeling like I'm going to spice it up today. And part of it is psychological. People don't want to look, they don't want to embarrass themselves by trying something new in front of others. Right? There are all these other people around. Nobody's talking to each other. Nobody knows each other. And you're kind of looking at what other people are doing. You know, they're kind of looking at you and you don't want to
look
like
an idiot.
You say
in your book that there are too many mirrors in gyms that actually, that's a problem.
Yeah. I think we need to pull back on the vanity a little bit and focus on being healthy.
And the functionality,
And functionality. And that's another thing I like about CrossFit boxes is that they get rid of the mirrors, there are no mirrors, and the focus is on performing the movement with a team of people. If you like sports, I love sports. I miss playing them on a regular basis, and that's one of the things that I dislike the most about New York City is it's hard to play sports here. Then you'll really enjoy the CrossFit environment because it's not just about competition, it's about camaraderie and being on a team with other people. So that's what I write about with CrossFit. But I do a lot of things. I do some barefoot running. I do a system called MoveNat, which is more out in nature and focused on skill-based movements out in natural Habitat. I do CrossFit a couple times a week. And then, you know, I love, if I go biking sometimes and things like that. So
occasionally track a woolly mammoth.
That's right. I wish.
That would be more paleo for sure. And you also, you throw in some interesting observations about our sleep patterns and also something called thermoregulation. Can you touch upon those?
Yeah, well, with sleep, what was sort of interesting is that I didn't find hunter-gatherers to be particularly useful in terms of advice for how to sleep better today. If you really want to understand sleep and how our sleep gets so screwed up, because it is, you want to look at polar explorers who go to the North Pole or the South Pole and they experience 6 months of day or 6 months of night, or astronauts or people in a submarine. Because all these people are suddenly, they no longer get that regular cycle of roughly 12 hours of day, 12 hours of night, and all sorts of, you know, everything goes wrong. Insomnia, hypersomnia, sleeping too much, lack of motivation, irritability, depression, thoughts of suicide. Do these things sound familiar and common to a lot of people today?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of overlap between different types of mental disorders and anxiety and circadian dysregulation.
Which we have now, we have light bulbs, we have a 24/7 lifestyle, we have shift workers, and of course that creates problems.
Exactly.
And let's touch briefly on thermoregulation, because I think that's a fascinating concept.
Yeah, so it's hot and cold and hot and cold exposure, and this is one of those areas, again, where modern life has become very monotonous. We have very temperature-controlled habitats, whether you're at home or in the car, in the office, and we don't experience very many temperature extremes except for a few days at the end of August, or you go in winter, you go build a snowman or something. But we used to have much more regular swings in temperature just throughout a 24-hour period where it would be warmer during the day, it would be cooler at night. And so some of the adventures I went on to explore this, I went to out to Coney Island, the sort of old famous boardwalk where they do the hot dog eating contest. And in the winter, on New Year's Day, they have the Coney Island Polar Bear Swim where about 1,500 crazy people, including myself, go for a swim in the icy cold Atlantic. And actually did this on a regular basis with a group out there. And I went with a friend of mine who, she always complained of being cold. She said, "I'm cold all the time. I fear the cold. I hate cold water. I hate cold weather. I don't want to go." And I said, "Come with me. We'll do it." She agreed. Rail thin woman. And we did it. And afterwards, she emailed me about a month later and she said, "I was not cold for the month of January."
It's called acclimation. It's actually one of the reasons why I personally love to run throughout the winter, because even though it's, you know, the wind's coming down the East River, you kind of acclimate and that's the way to experience winter.
Well,
in the Northeast,
you don't even have to do it that often or that much to get long-lasting effects. There are interesting studies showing that even just a few examples of cold exposure, say in the water, can last for 45 days, things like that. So it's it doesn't have to be time-consuming or a painful daily thing to do.
And that's one of the reasons that I like to do ocean swimming as long as I can. And, you know, my last swim was just a little colder than it was last week, and it's going to get progressively colder.
Hey, have you done any of the Russian baths here in New York City?
No, but I hear, you know, you get the heat and then you plunge into the ice water bath.
That's right. You've got to try that at some point. It's a ton of fun.
That sounds great. All right. Well, Kate, these and other insights are what you'll find in this fascinating book, The Paleo Manifesto. It's not just a diet book, but it contains lots of very specific diet suggestions and recommendations and a very well-informed scientific discussion. The Paleo Manifesto is just out. Is that right?
On September 17th.
Oh, okay. Great.
So we're just about there.
So you can pre-order it on Amazon. The author is John Durant, D-U-R-A-N-T. And you can also join John in some of his activities in New York, Paleo NYC and Barefoot Runners NYC.
Terrific. Thank you very much for having me on. That was a fun conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, John, and all the best. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.